This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll hear from Roz Savage. She's the only woman to ever row across all the major oceans by herself. We'll talk to Savage about conquering and surviving these harrowing trips at sea and about the environmental lessons she took away from them. But first, 12 years ago this week, the U.S. launched military operations in Afghanistan. It has claimed the lives of more than 2,200 U.S. service members and thousands of Afghan civilians. But war in this country predates the U.S. involvement. In his memoir, A Fort of Nine Towers, Qais Akbar Omar recounts his life in Kabul pre-9/11, when Afghanistan was engulfed in civil war and Taliban rule. Omar recently stopped by our studios to talk about his home country. He was here for an event with the World Affairs Council of Connecticut.
Well, every day was like a chaos. That's what, in the West, people know a lot about the Taliban, like how they were cruel and they did not let women to go to school and, all of the things that you hear all the time about them. But in the West in general, people don't know that what Afghans went through over the before that, for 4.5 years. When the Russian left Afghanistan, the seven factions who were formed by Americans in Peshawar in Pakistan, they came to Kabul. And everybody thought that they were like, our brother Mujahideen came back to Kabul and finally liberated this country from the claws of the Soviet Union. We used to call them the red, white guys. So they left. And then when they came, they were so disorganized. They did not get along with each other. And each faction took a neighborhood in Kabul, and they had so much money and weapons from Americans and other countries who gave them to defeat the Soviets, and they started sending rockets to each other, and people like us were stuck. So we spent months and months in the basement of our house, trapped, not being able to get out of the house and leave the country. And when we did that, we went to other provinces trying to get out of the country, but then these small factions start not just fighting in Kabul, but all over Afghanistan with each other. So war was all over the country, and all the borders closed, and Afghans had a hard time getting out of the country. So a big chunk of my book is about that 4.5 years of civil war before the Taliban came, which is why I mentioned in the book why the Taliban were welcomed when they first came, because people were so tired of the civil war. There were days that we had dead bodies on the street for days and weeks and months, and you could not go and pick up the dead body, and he's your uncle or your brother or your cousin. You go to pick him up, to bury him. Someone is on a high building or on a mountain, a sniper will shoot you, not knowing whether you are from the opposite faction or just someone who's trying to pick up a dead body and bury that person.
The civil wars that Qais writes about came in between the Soviet invasion in the 1980s and the U.S. invasion in 2001. Both of those failed, arguably. Is it possible to successfully conquer this country, I asked him?
No, it's impossible. Just read the history from the time Alexander came, Genghis Khan came. His nephew was killed there. And Genghis Khan was the only one who actually conquered the place. But he did not conquer in a sensible way. He destroyed everything. He destroyed the whole, cities of the cities, and he burned and he killed thousands of people. And for example, in Herat province, there were only seven survivors who, hid themselves under the minarets of a mosque. And then after 7 days, when they came out, the whole place was completely burned, and then they populated the whole place. And Genghis Khan was the only one. And then Englishmen came three times. They were defeated three times. Russian came three times. They were defeated. One thing about Afghans, they fight for millennia with each other because it's a tribal country. But when an outsider walks in, they unite. And then they say, let's get them out. Let's drive them out of this country. And that's why nobody can conquer that place if you want to try to fight them. But if you go and be sensible and say, okay, what is the problem? What is the solution? And how can we find a solution that everybody benefits from it? And then everybody walks out happy and winning, which is what we call Loya Jirga. Loya Jirga is a national assembly. The heads of all tribes come together in a mosque or in a big room, and they talk about the problems, why they're fighting, what is the problem, and then they find a peaceful solution that everybody benefits from, and then you walk out happy.
During his life in Afghanistan, Qais saw the best and most beautiful parts of Kabul, but that peace and joy, he tells me, quickly turned to war and despair.
When civil war started, then all of us had to go at the basement of our house where it was safe. And the grown-ups, my uncles, my father, my grandfather, will have these small radios holding in front of their eyes or next to their ears, listening to the BBC World Service. What's happening, which was the only source of information for us all over the country, what was happening. And then every time you look at them, and I was 7, 8, 10 years old, and every time you look at them, that uncle who used to take you to the movie theater every evening, and you know, and then buy you ice cream, is now sitting in that corner, and he looks so grim and so tired and exhausted, but listening to all of this and so sad. It has a huge effect on you. You see everybody. You see the transformation from where you were and where you are now. And then you wait for, and outside there are thousands of rockets raining all over the city. And making, you know, you can hear when they are released and make this shoo sound, and then when it lands and woof, and it just shakes the whole ground. So you see, you hear that all the time, all day long, all night long. And when you go out, you don't have a bathroom in the basement, so you have to go and use the bathroom just to pee in along the tree or outside. And you see the bullets in the air. It's like, it's not Nowruz or Eid when we celebrate with firing, with firecrackers. But it looks like that. But everybody, when you come down the stairs, everybody's so sad. Mm-hmm. It's not so happy. So you everything is kind of confused. So deep down, you're waiting that I wish a rocket comes and lands here and kills us all, so I don't have to see the rest of the family being so sad and so disappointed.
We're listening back to a conversation I had with Qais Akbar Omar. He wrote the book A Fort of Nine Towers. It's a memoir about his life in Afghanistan from the Soviet Union's exit to the ousting of the Taliban. Qais stopped by our studios recently as part of an event with the World Affairs Council, and he talked about the future of Afghanistan and what he thinks will happen after more than a decade of U.S. occupation.
Nobody exactly knows what's going to happen next after 2014. We had a lot of accomplishments over the past 12 years since the Americans came there, but then we made a lot of mistakes as well. If the Americans, as they say, they're going to walk out in 2014, I think Afghanistan will go under another, the chaos that we have never even imagined. Because, and I can give you the reasons, those seven factions who liberated Afghanistan from the claws of the Soviet Union, they came, they fought, then they left. They were driven away by the Taliban. They are back. Now they are running the country, basically. They are running the country. They are in the parliament, in the government, everything, the ministers, all of that. The Taliban, who were kicked away by Americans after 9/11, they are back. They're basically ruling the whole country. You don't say that Taliban are in Afghanistan, but basically they are not in Kabul, but they are all over the place. So at the moment, America is there, and we have a relatively, you know, peaceful country, even though we had a lot of suicide bombers. But as soon as they walk out, will we have another like Soviet Union walking out of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan will undergo another civil war? We don't know. Maybe.
In addition to his writing, Qais Akbar Omar worked in the family business of making carpets. But some thought it was a cursed business, as bombs would fall on warehouses and destroy their inventory. So he says it wasn't really passed down from generation to generation.
I taught myself how to weave carpets and, you know, design them and make them. And I made my first carpet and took it to Chicken Street. We are in Kabul. There are a lot of carpet shops. And I took it to a guy who was a family friend. And I said, please buy this carpet. And he looked at my design and started laughing. And he said, what the hell is this? And I said, well, this is a carpet. And he said, who's going to buy this piece of junk? And I said, can you please keep it in your shop for a few days? And he said, no. And I said, just for the sake of our family. Our families know each other for so long. And he said, only for 1 week. And I said, for at least, you know, one week. And he said, only for 4 days. All right. And I left it there. 3 days came. 3 days later, he came and knocked on the door and handed me $300. And I was surprised. And then he handed me $1,000. And I said, can you make 100 more? Because I found a customer for that carpet who's an Afghan in Germany. And he found a customer, you know, he thinks that he will sell this carpet very, very well, this design. Can you make 100 more? And then at age 17, I had 45 women working for me during the years of the Taliban. So I got a lot of people working, yeah.
That's Qais Akbar Omar. His memoir chronicles life in post-Soviet, pre-U.S. invasion Afghanistan. It's called A Fort of Nine Towers. Coming up, we'll talk to Roz Savage. She's the only woman to have rowed solo across all major oceans. You can join the conversation, email Where We Live at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Have you ever wanted to make a big change in your life and go on a big adventure? You know, try something where you could really push yourself. Well, Roz Savage did just that. But the challenge she took was bigger than most of us could even imagine. She became the first woman to row solo across all the world's major oceans. But she's not just doing this for herself. She's doing it for a bigger purpose, to raise awareness about global sustainability and climate change. She's a United Nations climate hero, an athlete ambassador for 350.org, a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and a 2012 Yale World Fellow. We spoke with her back in April. Roz Savage, welcome to Where We Live.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks, John.
What were you doing and what was your life like before you decided to become an ocean rower?
It was very different. I'd been working as a management consultant in London for 11 years. And I suppose it looked like a nice enough life. Had the big house and the sports car and the successful husband and all the things that you would have thought might make me happy. But somehow there seemed to be this real mismatch between the person I was pretending to be in my everyday life and who I thought I might be on the inside. The trouble is I didn't really know who I was on the inside. So I had to reach a point where I was just at a real low point in my career, in my marriage, in everything, to kind of give me a kick in the backside and make me think I really need to do something to get my life back on track here. And it might sound really weird. I'm sure a lot of my friends thought I'd completely lost the plot, giving up what this apparently perfect life to go in search of something bigger. But I think you just know on the inside when something needs to change.
Was there a specific moment or something that said, this is what I want to do, this is who I am that I'm going to change into, or was this an evolution over time?
There was quite a pivotal moment that led to an evolution. When I was going through this kind of dark place of self-questioning and self-doubt, I turned to self-help books, as you do. And one of those books suggested writing two versions of your own obituary, the one that you want and the one that you're heading for if you carry on as you are. And I can remember how I felt as I was writing my fantasy obituary. It wasn't really about what I would do. It was about the kind of person that I would be. And I thought back to the obituaries that I'd read that I really admired. And they were the people who seemed to just really grab hold of life, who would get out there and try anything at least once. And whether it succeeded or whether it failed, they would learn something from it and move forwards. And as I was writing that, the pen was racing across the paper. And it felt so real to me that when I got to the end of it, I thought, wow, what a great life I've had. And then had to kind of slap myself on the forehead and remind myself that was just the fantasy version. Mm. It wasn't actually my real life. The other obituary, the one that I was actually heading for if I carried on as I was, looked nice and safe and conventional. But I realised that that just wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't who I felt myself to be. So by doing that exercise, I'd had a glimpse into my real potential, into the life that I really wanted to have. But that was deeply scary for me because I was so very much living in that settled world. All of my friends were married, mortgaged, doing similar jobs to what I did. I just couldn't even begin to imagine what my life might look like if it didn't look like that. So it actually took me a while after that to pluck up the courage to really start making some significant changes. But I think that's maybe the way that life goes. You'll have a moment of insight, and maybe if you're an exceptionally courageous person, you act on it immediately. But for the rest of us, maybe it takes a bit longer to get our heads around it. But you still need that insight in the first place, because once you have that knowledge, once you've seen what life could be, it's almost impossible to pretend you don't know it without feeling like you're really betraying yourself.
Now, as I suggested in the introduction, though, I've known people who've made these switches in life, and often what that looks like is you leave a comfortable job or life to go work on a farm someplace, or you open up your own business when you've always only worked for someone else, or you take a few months and you hike the Appalachian Trail. But the thing that you ended up doing with your life goes so far beyond that, it's almost hard to comprehend or put that in an obituary. How did you get from that moment of epiphany to Rod Savage, ocean rower?
It actually made perfect sense to me at the time. So after I'd written the obituary in about 1998, I then left my job in 2000, ended up sadly leaving the marriage in 2002, although I'm happy to say that we're still very good friends. It was in 2004 that the idea to row across oceans came and clobbered me over the head one day. And what had led up to that was I'd had an environmental epiphany earlier in 2004. For most of my life, I had been completely oblivious to environmental issues. It just wasn't on my radar. When I was a child, I suppose I was aware of nature. I grew up in a fairly poor family. My parents were both Methodist preachers. But what they did do was to ensure that I got a good education and to make sure that I got out there and could recognise birds and trees and flowers, and so a sense of connection with nature there. But then when I'd gone off into my London yuppie lifestyle, I'd sort of forgotten about all of that. And I was one of those people who, when they threw stuff away, just thought it went away, didn't really think about where it went to, who would refurbish the house just because it needed a little bit of updating rather than because it desperately needed refurbishing. I wasn't really mindful of the consequences of my actions from the environmental perspective. But then in early 2004, I was reading this book about the Hopi tribe of North America. And like many indigenous people, they have a very deep understanding of the interconnectedness between humans and the planet that we live on. And when I read about this, I was just struck between the eyes by this fundamental truth. It just seemed so obvious now that it was presented to me in that way. And I was shocked that I'd never really thought about it in those terms before. And when I looked around, it seemed that a lot of the people around me weren't really thinking about it either, judging from their actions. And so I thought, this is absolutely the most important issue in the whole wide world right now, and I have to do something about it. And so I was really looking for a way in which I could get people's attention to get this message across to them about our desperate need to take better care of our Earth, because it's the only one we've got. And it was at around that time that I happened to meet a guy who had rowed across the Atlantic with, of all people, his mother. And so all of these ideas sort of collided. My desire at that time to kind of establish my self-reliance, the environmental mission, the fact that I'd rowed in college was enough to give me the happy delusion that this might be something I was vaguely qualified to do. And this light bulb went on over my head, and I thought, that's what I'll do. I will row across the world's oceans to raise environmental awareness.
We're talking with Roz Savage, an ocean rower, a sustainability advocate, a Yale World Fellow. I'm sure many of our listeners want to hear about this first voyage. When you decided, I'm going to do this, you have a very specialized boat, and what does it take to get in a boat on one side of the Atlantic and then start across by yourself? What went into that?
A lot of naive optimism. It really helps. I had 14 months from when I decided that I was going to do this until the date when the race started. As my first ocean, I took part in the Atlantic rowing race. So about 26 boats were going to set out from La Gomera in the Canaries to row 3,000 miles to Antigua in the Caribbean. So in that time, I had to acquire a boat, get it all fitted out, attempt to raise sponsorship, mostly failed. I trained really hard, up to 16 hours a day on the rowing machine, plus lots of weight training. I also did some psychological preparations. I really knew nothing about the ocean, so I had to learn sea survival, first aid at sea, celestial navigation, basic meteorology. There was just so much that I had to learn and do that actually, luckily, it kept me too busy during those 14 months for me to really stop and indulge in moments of doubt. I think those moments when you go, what am I thinking? I have no idea what I'm doing here. I'm already in my mid-30s. I've got no previous history of this kind of adventure. It felt so right that I should be doing this project. I had such a strong sense of mission about it that I just kept on running and somehow managed to pull it all together and arrived at the start line thinking that I was as well prepared as it was possible for a complete rookie to be. But I was in for a few surprises.
The psychological preparation is the part of that that's most interesting, because obviously there's a lot of naive optimism that goes into powering a boat across the Atlantic Ocean yourself anyway. But after days and days and days of being by yourself, I would assume that the psychological toll is quite great. Talk about that piece of it, about isolation in the middle of the ocean.
It was hell. It was really the most challenging thing I'd ever done by a very large margin. Very early on, my stereo broke, which might sound fairly trivial, but without that, I really had nothing but my own thoughts to entertain myself for what ended up being 3.5 months at sea. And, you know, obviously I'm endlessly entertaining, but by the end of the first month, I was getting pretty sick of myself. It really does make you go into deep places, or even if you don't want to go there, when you're in a situation where you don't have much sensory input, just things come up, memories from the past, old ideas. You're really brought face to face with some of those old demons. And for me, that was things like self-doubt, a lack of self-confidence. I think practically every day out there, I felt like I was failing. I was also very, very scared early on. The first 2 weeks, I can remember just at night times, I would lie in my cabin, just kind of curled up in the fetal position. And the waves sounded so loud, I was convinced that the boat was going to break apart. But after 2 weeks of being pretty much terrified, you sort of reach a point where you get tired of being scared all the time. And you think, well, the boat hasn't broken up yet, so hopefully it'll carry on not breaking up. And I haven't cracked up yet, so hopefully I'll carry on not cracking up. And you sort of... I don't think I ever really reached an equilibrium on that particular voyage, but over the course of the other voyages, you find a way of being where you just take it one day or one rowing shift or even just the next 100 oar strokes at a time. You just break it down into small and manageable chunks, while at the same time holding a vision of where you're heading for and how wonderful it's going to be when you set foot back on dry land. And I refuse to think about anything between what I have to do today and that vision of where I want to end up. Because if you start thinking about all the thousands of miles that you've got to row and all the potential problems that you could have in the interim, it just becomes too overwhelming. And believe me, I really did learn this by doing it the wrong way first.
Well, and before we take our first break, as we head into a conversation about what this has done to raise environmental awareness, I would think that one thing this very long voyage, these very long voyages have shown you is something that most of us don't get a chance to understand, is just how big the ocean is, just how much of the planet is out there that we don't ever see. Because when you fly from London to the States, it takes, 6 or 7 hours, and, you know, you have a little nap and then you're done. And that's the way we live our lives. But 3.5 months at sea shows you a lot about how big something is.
Well, yes. Although something that really surprised me is that moving at about 2 miles an hour, I've managed to row around most of the Earth in the space of a total of 520-something days, which actually surprises me how small the Earth is.
If you put it like that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why when I think about 7 billion people, 7.1 billion now, living on what I perceive as actually being a surprisingly small planet, I'm amazed that we're not up to our eyeballs in garbage already when you think of, you know, just how much you see being picked up off a street corner in Manhattan or somewhere like that. So I think it actually, for me, really gave me a perception that the world's not as big as we think it is. And we can't keep just messing it up the way that we are. That in fact, we do need to become much more aware of our inputs and outputs and manage those much more carefully.
We're talking with Roz Savage, who's an ocean rower, the first woman to row solo across all three of the major oceans. She's a sustainability and environmental advocate, a Yale World Fellow. Talk more about her environmental mission coming up next, right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're speaking with Roz Savage. She's an ocean rower, an advocate for environmental issues and global sustainability. She's a Yale World Fellow as well. Since you've taken these massive rowing trips over the course of the last several years, and you've become a speaker on the circuit around the world and talked to people, I'm sure that many people have asked you lots of questions. People have raised lots of interesting points to you. What are the big environmental issues that you care most deeply about right now?
I've got a slightly quirky answer to that. There are many environmental issues, and I think for some people it seems like this many-headed monster, and it seems like as soon as you cut one head off, then another head sprouts. But I think if you can actually get to the heart of the monster and tackle the problems there, then we're really onto something. And for me, that heart is what's going on in 7.1 billion human heads. Like the way that we think about our Earth, our relationship with it, that somehow we've become very disconnected. We've lost sight of the fact that without a healthy planet, then we can't be healthy humans, that whatever toxins we put out there on a finite Earth, they're just going to come right back around at us. So if we can adjust the thinking, if we can get people to really understand sustainability in its most literal sense, like this piece of plastic, if I throw this away today, if everybody in the world threw away one piece of plastic today, and we all did that for the next 100 years, then what is the consequence of that going to be? Is that a pattern that we can sustain indefinitely or not? And you know, whether it's burning up fossil fuels or throwing away toxic rubbish, if it's something that can't be done by everybody on an ongoing basis, then it's not sustainable. And so if we could somehow reconnect ourselves with our natural environment, not just in a kind of dippy hippie kind of way, but actually in a this is crucial to our human survival kind of a way, then I think we could actually get right to the heart of this many-headed monster.
But this idea of being crucial to human survival is so interesting, because depending on where you are in the Earth, that calculus in one's mind is very different. Living the life you led before in London as a management consultant with a nice car and a nice house and many of the trappings that we have here in Connecticut, you seem at a distance from these things because you're living a perfectly good life, being a consumer, and you're not up close to the outflow of that, the problems that you may be causing. On the other end, if you are living in an impoverished country, in a developing country, the long-term sustainability of the planet is much less important than eating that day and the things that you need to do to eat that day. And so it seems as though we're a little bit at a crossroads. A whole big group of us don't care for one reason, and a whole other big group of us don't care for another reason.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, and that's one of the biggest challenges. And something that I've been talking about recently is about redefining success, how all this affluence that we have in the Western world isn't actually necessarily leading people to feel that they are leading successful lives, because they're neglecting the more emotional aspects, their relationships, their altruism, their contribution to their communities. So I think that if we're going to have a hope of sustainability, then we in the Western world need to take a more holistic view of success. And if we can get that right, we could actually have happier human beings who aren't trying to fill some kind of personal spiritual void by endless consumerism. They're actually looking for happiness in the right places, so they could at the same time reduce their environmental footprint. But also at the same time as feeling connected to nature, I think we need to engender more compassion for our fellow human beings and realize that while such inequality exists in the world, it kind of diminishes us all. I mean, if it's sounds weird, but sometimes coming back off the ocean, I feel a bit like a space alien landing. Mm. And I sort of look at humanity with a much more objective eye than I do when I'm really caught up in land-based life. And coming in from the outside, I can remember how I felt when I arrived in Hawaii after rowing from San Francisco and was being driven through downtown Waikiki, having spent 3.5 months way out in the ocean, pretty much in survival mode. As I'm going past these shops full of designer clothes and watches and jewellery and techno widgets, I'm just thinking, well, I can't eat it, drink it or row with it, so what's it all for? I am mystified by some aspects of human behaviour. They just seem so strange. So many people running around trying to earn money to buy the stuff, going out and buying the stuff, transporting the stuff, selling the stuff, maintaining the stuff. It's a very stuff-based life in our Western world.
Today our guest is Roz Savage. She's the first woman to row solo across all the major oceans. She's an environmental activist and a Yale World Fellow. This intensive leadership training program brings together people from all over the world. Roz Savage, what exactly did you do as part of the Yale World Fellow program?
Wow, it was kind of a crash course in global affairs. We had two core seminars each week. One was the global affairs seminar. The other one was personal and professional development, in which we worked with a psychologist who specialised in group dynamics. And I think what it really did for me, we were this cohort of 16 world fellows from 13 different countries. And it really just opened my eyes to what's going on around the world, the different challenges facing different societies, even, you know, new countries being created, defining their own constitutions as we speak. It really gave, I think, coming from little old England, we've been around for so long and, you know, things don't really change all that much, give or take a few details. And I think it really just opened my eyes to the fact that we are very much a world in a state of flux, not just environmentally, but politically and demographically. And it's boiling pot of a world out there.
It's so interesting you say little old England. It wasn't so terribly long ago. Little old England had its hand in so many different parts of the world. England was, it did stretch across the globe, and things have changed so very much in just the last, 150 years for England. Do you feel as though your home country is more isolated perhaps than it used to be from the rest of the world?
No, I don't really. I think that we actually, particularly in London, we have a very diverse population. We've got people from all over Europe and many Commonwealth countries as well. So I actually feel like we're quite an exceptionally, I would like to think, we're a very tolerant and very diverse culture there. And also because we tend to travel quite a lot, mostly in search of better weather, we get to see quite a lot of other parts of the world as well. So I am quite interested by the effect that it has on a person, what country they come from and how closely they identify with that country. And I think I went through a very long stage of wanting to be American, but I think I've reached my peace with being English. Actually, now I really rather like it.
I want to bring in Michael Capello, who's director of the Yale World Fellows Program, to talk a bit about who they do bring together in New Haven. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John. And Roz, it's great to hear your voice.
Hi, Michael. Absolutely great to hear your voice again, too.
So Roz talked about being with these other people from all over the world. Tell us about who you bring together, who you're looking for as a Yale World Fellow.
Sure. So I'll begin simply by saying that I think to know Roz is to know our program. She really represents many of the qualities that we seek to identify and also to nurture through the World Fellows Program: courage, integrity, and a commitment to using one's personal gifts to make a positive difference in the world. So it's our mandate really is quite broad, and our mission is to cultivate and inspire a community of globally engaged leaders, people like Roz, who are committed to positive change. And they do that through dialogue and action that's really cross-disciplinary in nature. So we look to identify people who are mid-career professionals. So these are practitioners, not academics per se. And we bring them to Yale for the purpose of providing this small group with free access to all of the rich intellectual resources that a world-class university like Yale can provide. And we do it at a critical point in their professional development. You know, I like to say that we select our World Fellows based not only on their record of accomplishment, but also on the sense that their best days are still ahead of them. So these are people typically in their 30s and 40s. They come from all over the world. Our network now, after 12 years of the program, includes 238 World Fellows from 81 countries. They come to Yale really with a sense of being at a point in their career where they recognize that there's still a next step that they want to take. And we try to provide the kind of intensive academic experience, interaction and engagement with students and faculty, and most importantly, an engagement with each other that allows them to really develop the kind of courage and inspiration to go on and accomplish even greater things.
I would think, Roz, that engagement with one another is one of the most important things from what you're trying to do. We've been talking throughout the course of this hour about you wanting to learn and understand more about the human condition, not just about the environment, but as an environmental activist, understanding why people do what they do. And I would assume that sitting down with people from all over the world who have very different worldviews and experiences is going to help you to do that.
I think so. I think what this really comes down to is motivation. This is a subject that fascinates me because it's something that I often lacked on the ocean and that I've really had to try and figure out how to create it. So how do you motivate people to change their behavior? Because it's a big ask. And to understand the diversity of like coming in positions, the background that people come from, their cultural reference points. Yeah, every country is configured so differently in terms of its religion, its stage of economic development, its climate, which I think also has quite a profound impact on national psyche. To understand, even begin to understand that diversity is to maybe become a bit overwhelmed at times by the scale of the challenge in changing that thinking on a global scale. But without having that insight, you just can't even begin. So the program was fantastic for me, as you say, largely for meeting the other members of my cohort from other countries, but even amongst the professors, the L professors that would come in and speak to us every week, to get exposure to their ideas, and in fact, many of them are from different countries as well, just to get the it was such a really mind-expanding program in so many different dimensions.
Michael Capello, talk a bit more about what leadership means. When people like Roz come out of your Yale World Fellows program and they're learning leadership skills, what exactly does that translate to in your mind?
So our view or our sort of approach to leadership development can probably best be thought of as inspirational. And really what we try to do is provide our fellows with examples, both from within the network of World Fellows, but also from within examples from around the Yale community of examples of great leadership. And we also provide our students here on campus with the World Fellows as a means of really inspiring them to achieve positions of leadership and to take responsibility for making a positive difference in the world. So leading by example is really a fundamental sort of pillar of what we try to illustrate during the fellows' time here. I've often felt that what really can accelerate someone's professional development and what can allow them to take that step forward in their professional lives is something that Roz alluded to, that really the opportunity to see others from completely different parts of the world, ethnic backgrounds, sectors or disciplines, willing to take on tremendous challenges. And I think that's a very inspiring opportunity for people who frequently have been very focused quite narrowly on a particular career path. I mean, in Roz's case, you know, she talks about drawing that line between her ocean rowing life and the post ocean rowing life. It really, I think what she illustrates is how important it is to be around people who are also striving to do important things.
Michael Capello, thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts about the Yale World Fellows Program. And I want to thank our guest, Roz Savage, who's an ocean rower, a sustainability advocate, and Yale World Fellow. You're going to continue speaking on these issues all around the world. I know that you have a lot of speaking engagements coming up. Are you going to be talking again locally here? How can people find out more about you?
They could go to my website at rozsavage.com. That's rozsavage.com. And I'll be publicizing any speaking engagements on there.
It's been great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks for joining us.